sort of. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. It's always lovely to come back to Cambridge. And I've spoken to this august society on more than one occasion before. So thank you once again for inviting me. And also, of course, to John and Jackie, who are putting me up, and to the people who've organised the day-long tomorrow. Now, what I'm going to talk about this evening is, as was already said, this rather strange expression, clearly visible but hard to see, and I'll explain what I mean by that. But to put it into a slightly larger context, my recent work, for those of you who are not familiar with that, I'm a writer and a teacher of Buddhism in a broad sense. I don't particularly identify with a given school of Buddhism, but I'm particularly interested at the moment, and have been for the last few years, in trying to recover a sense of the historical figure called Siddhartha Gautama, who lived and taught in northeast India in the 5th century BC. And this is, in a sense, the sort of culmination of my life's active involvement in Buddhist teachings and Buddhist practice. I consider myself a practicing Buddhist. In other words, these teachings and texts are not merely of academic interest to me, but they speak to my condition, as the Quakers say. And I try to put them into practice, and I'm seeking very much a framework for how to live a human life in all areas of our humanity. In other words, I'm very reluctant to think of Buddhism as being essentially about, say, meditation. That's certainly an important and integral part, but I'm more concerned with trying to articulate for our times a philosophy of life, an ethical framework for our relationships with others in this life, and also a contemplative practice. And traditionally, these are called in Buddhism sila, samadhi, and punya. Sila means virtue or ethics, samadhi means concentration or meditation, and punya, usually translated as wisdom, which is not incorrect, in a sense is broader than that. Punya has to do with discriminative awareness. We might even translate it as intelligence. And I think in our Western tradition, it's quite comparable to how in the Greek tradition we understood the word philosophy as the love of wisdom, sophia. And I think the punya, or the wisdom or intelligence aspect of Buddhist teaching, is pretty close to that. So what this project that I'm involved in, trying to recover a clearer sense of who the historical Buddha was, and this has been aided considerably in recent years by an increased historical understanding of the conditions under which the Buddha lived and taught. It's also, now most scholars accept, a quite different dating of the Buddha's life. He's now thought to have lived between roughly 480 and 400 BC, whereas previously, and still in traditional Buddhist societies, his dates are 563 to 483. So he's come about 80 years closer to our time. Now that might sound like an academic, you know, curiosity. It actually has some quite significant knock-on effects. I may touch or not touch on that in the course of this evening. But it's not only about understanding who the Buddha was as a person, what kind of society he lived in, what sort of religious background he came from, how he had to interact with the people of his time. But it's also, of course, trying in a parallel process to get a clearer understanding of what was it in this person's teaching that was so striking that people remembered it in quite considerable detail. That was passed down over generations, and possibly what is the most curious thing of all is that we're sitting here at a Unitarian church this evening talking about it all. So, for whatever reasons you're here, and of course I don't know why most of you are here, it's quite remarkable, really, how this person who lived nearly 2,500 years ago still exerts a kind of compelling attraction on people living in a very, very different world to the one that he would have known and inhabited. And what this points to, and you of course could say the same thing about Christianity, is that something about what the Buddha was saying was not just about conditions in 5th century BC India. What he was in a sense addressing was the condition of being human, the condition of being mortal, of being born, being subject to sickness and subject to aging, and finally having to die. And the real question, therefore, is how do we live this life in a way in which our humanity can optimally flourish? And again, some of you might pick up, I'm utilizing language here from the Greek tradition. So what I'm interested in is trying to pinpoint the features of Siddhartha Gautama's teaching that you cannot derive from the culture of his time. So whenever the Buddha says, for example, oh, when this person is suffering this particular problem because in a previous life they did this, that, or the other, that to me is simply a feature of the worldview of that time in India. In fact, not only in India, the idea of karma and rebirth was actually just as much prevalent in Athens as it was in Varanasi at that period. So I take those sorts of statements and just put them to one side. I'm not saying that they're somehow therefore wrong or incorrect. It's a feature of that culture and that time, rather than a feature of a teaching that is not derivative of a particular cultural period or set of religious beliefs. Now, perhaps the key term in all of this teaching is the word the Dharma. The Dharma. And I'm not even going to try to translate it. Seriously, I don't think it's worth the trouble. Roughly speaking, if you like, Dharma means something like law, way of life maybe. But the Buddha uses it in a highly distinctive way. And the first passage I want to look at, in fact both of them, I'm going to look at two passages this evening. Both are drawn from the Pali Canon, and both concern the Buddha's understanding of what constitutes the Dharma. Okay? And I think what we might discover in considering these texts is that he has a very clear, very consistent view of what constitutes the Dharma. But by looking at the two passages, we'll see how, in some ways, they conflict. And hence the title of this presentation. He talks of the Dharma as being clearly visible, on the one hand, and he talks of the Dharma in another text as being hard to see. And that's the conundrum I want to dwell on this evening. How can something be clearly visible but hard to see? And that something is not just some minor element of his teaching, but it's actually the Dharma itself is clearly visible but hard to see. So the first text I want to consider is from the Majjhima Nikaya. These are the the collection of middle-length discourses, and if you want to look it up later, it's Majjhima 26, the 26th middle-length discourse. And this is called the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the discourse on the noble quest. It's a very important discourse for the simple reason that it's one of the few times where the Buddha actually talks about his own process. He answers the question that many of us probably have: how did you get to be who you are? What did you do? And so he describes in this text how he leaves home. He describes how he goes and studies meditation under two masters of meditation of his period, Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, both of whom teach him deep states of mental absorption, which later became the seventh and the eighth jhanas in Buddhism. Jhana means like absorbed concentration. So the Buddha abandons these teachers because, although he masters these jhanas, they don't actually resolve the questions that are central to his life. And I think what these central questions are basically the questions of existence, existential questions. What does it mean to be born, to be subject to sickness and aging, and to die? That, I think fairly unarguably, is the conundrum with which the whole Buddhist project begins. And the extent to which we're all subject to these things, at least I suspect everyone in this room got born, probably going to get sick, going to fall ill, and one day will die. It's the primary existential question. So after he'd exhausted the conventional spiritual religious options of his period, in other words, getting into very deep states of jhanic absorption, he also supposedly underwent all sorts of ascetic practices. At a certain point, he basically says, you know, I'm not getting anywhere with this. And he sits down beneath a tree, although the text doesn't actually describe that, and arrives at what we understand as his awakening or his enlightenment. Now, just to put that a bit in context, I think it's a little bit difficult to swallow that, you know, he leaves home at the age of 28, 29, does the jhana practices, does extreme ascetic practices, sits beneath a tree, and kapow, everything is understood. That's not quite credible. I think it's almost certainly the case, given how he then subsequently teaches, that he was deeply familiar with the ideas of his time. He was very skilled in dialectics, in discussion, in debate. He was very learned, not only in the philosophy of the Jains and the Brahmins, but also he was very much au fait with, for example, the practice of traditional medicine in India. He was clearly very observant of the way people, particularly artisans, doctors, goldsmiths, farmers, carpenters, woodworkers, and so on, did their work. Now that, I think, is a kind of important point. So when he comes to teach, I think we need to drop this rather mystical version that he just suddenly had this massive revelation of the nature of reality or something, and then he, just for the rest of his life, just taught the Dharma. But I think we have to try to see what he's doing in the context of his time, in the context of his society, the economic situation, etc. and so on. But I'm wandering off of it. I'm sorry. Okay, so in this text, in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, there's one passage where he describes, I think, very concisely and clearly what it was that he arrived at. He says, this Dhamma, same word, this Dhamma I have reached. In other words, as a quest, at a certain point, he arrived at what he calls the Dhamma, this Dharma. And he says, this Dhamma I have reached is deep, hard to see. That's my first phrase in my title. Difficult to awaken to. Quiet and excellent. Not confined by thought. Subtle. Sensed or felt, intuited by the wise. But people love their place, he continues. They delight and revel in their place. It is hard for people who love, delight, and revel in their place to see this ground. This conditionality, conditioned arising. And also hard to see this ground, the stilling of all inclinations, the relinquishing of bases, the fading away of reactivity, desirelessness, stopping, nirvana. So, I've given a great deal of thought to this rather short passage. Just to give me some sort of credibility and backup, scholars maintain that this text is probably the earliest account that's come down to us of the Buddha's awakening. There are better known passages, like when he remembers all his past lives and so on, but this passage is probably the original, or the earliest at least, recalled text that we have on the nature of awakening. I use the word awakening, not enlightenment. And this awakening is quite strikingly described here, not as some sort of breakthrough into the nature of reality. It's not about gaining some sort of privileged or mystical cognition or knowing of how things are. It's not mentioned at all. And in fact, what's particularly striking, at least for me, in this passage is that nowhere in this text is there a verb connected to the root jñā, to know. It's not about knowing anything at all. Likewise, there's no word like truth here either. Instead, the Buddha's awakening is described here as a radical shift in perspective. That's the point, I think. And what is this perspective, or this shift in perspective? Well, it seems to come down to two things. Our relationship to what he calls one's place, and his relationship to what he calls our ground. Now, the words in Pali for place and ground are actually roughly synonymous. The word for place, or the word I've translated as place, is alaya. Alaya. Alaya is actually a word we're all used to. We've all used it many times in our lives. Those mountains in the north of India, what are they called? Himalayas, right. It's the Himalaya. Him means snow. Alaya means place, or foundation, or base. The base, the ground, the place, the snow. And the other word he uses is tanha, which again means ground. In Sanskrit, an equivalent would be adhisthana. And sometimes God is spoken of as the adhisthana, the ground of everything. Now, what's striking here is that for the Buddha, his awakening came about through being able somehow to let go of his place and to encounter, or the word he uses is to see, his ground. It's seeing, it's not knowing. It's seeing, it's as though he saw it with his eyes opened. And hence we get the idea of awakening rather than enlightenment, which again suggests that what he experienced is something like what we all experience every morning when the alarm goes, or when we wake up, whenever it might be. We wake up. That's the governing metaphor. Enlightenment suggests a light being cast in a dark place, which he also uses, the image of light. But I feel in some ways the root sense of waking up is rather key in this passage. And this waking up was basically a waking up from a life in which you're primarily fixated upon securing your place in the world. In other words, to love, delight, and revel in your place is to be somehow attached or, let's say, preoccupied with being, let's say, a citizen of the United Kingdom. That's a place. Or it has to do with the attachment you have to your position in society, your place in the social order of things. Or it may have to do with your place at work, the position you have in the company, or whatever particular credentials or qualifications you have that allow you to inhabit a particular place in society, in whatever form that might be. And our place also is very much to do with our, let's say, where we stand in our political views, in our religious views. Psychologically, it has to do with our sense of place in terms of being me, of having a very solid sense of self-identity. All of this has to do with our place. And as long as we are preoccupied with reinforcing or somehow sustaining our sense of place, to that degree, it will be hard to see our ground. So when he says this Dharma is hard to see, it's hard to see because we love, delight, and revel in our place. It's quite clear, really. But it's hard, but people love their place, they delight and revel in their place. It is hard for people who love, delight, and revel in their place to see this ground. And how does he describe this ground? Well, there's two aspects to it. It's a twofold ground. One aspect of this ground is what he calls paticca samuppada, which we can translate as conditioned arising. It's sometimes translated dependent origination. It's often depicted as 12 links, but that's a rather later development of the idea. The basic idea of conditioned arising is summarized in the rather famous statement, when this is, that arises, when this is not, that does not arise. And in many ways, therefore, conditionality or conditioned arising is basically an acceptance or a relationship to the causal nature of life. The cause-effect nature of life, that things happen for a reason. And again, another word, another sense of tanna, which I've translated as ground, is also the reason for something. The reason, the ground for something. We say in German, ein Grund, in German, a ground, also means a proof. In other words, it means what demonstrates something to be something else. So ground here, on the one hand, refers to the basic law of cause and effect, but not in an abstract sense. Not just as a theory, but actually as something intimately observed, both within the workings of one's mind, in one's understanding of human relations, in the way one has observed, for example, the natural world, you know, the growth of plants and flowers and fruits and crops and so on. That this, I think, is what informs the Buddha of what constitutes the ground of life. Now, I think it must almost certainly be the case that he has in the back of his mind the idea that this word tamang, or ground, would have, in for many of the people of his time, referred to God, or Brahma, some kind of ultimate reality that's beyond the conditioned world, that is essentially unconditioned. But what the Buddha does here, which is characteristic of his style of teaching, is to take a term that has one use in the society and turn it on its head. So his idea of the ground is not something permanent and transcendent and unitary like God, but it is actually the conditioned world itself, a conditionality, that which is constantly rising and passing and changing, that which we influence by our thoughts, our speech and our acts, all of the processes that constitute what we would call today the phenomenal world, the world of what we can experience, the world of life and death, the world of morality and cause and effect. But there's another aspect of this ground, and that is what he calls nirvana. And nirvana, he describes it here, is the stilling of inclinations, the fading away of reactivity, desirelessness stopping, nirvana. Now, of course, nirvana is one of these words that has entered the English language and is very much associated with Buddhism and Hinduism, particularly Buddhism. And it's very often thought to mean the end of suffering, the end of any kind of pain or discomfort. And when the Buddha dies, we say that he enters the final nirvana, the parinirvana. In other words, nirvana is, in some senses, the kind of the goal of Buddhist practice. And it's something in which our habitual day-to-day experience that we know it now is transcended in a condition in which there's no more dukkha, there's no more suffering, there's no more reactivity, there's no more craving, hatred, ignorance, etc., etc. But I don't think that's what he means here. Because he talks of seeing his ground. Seeing his ground as a conditioned, as a mortal creature, but also seeing his ground as a creature or a being who has the possibility of living in a non-reactive way. In a way in which the habitual patterns of greed and hatred and delusion have at least momentarily been stilled. They're not operative anymore, at least they're not influencing or determining what we think and say and do. Nirvana, in that sense, is our life minus egoism, attachment, hatred, and so on. Now, this is difficult to see too, because we, once again, love, delight, and revel in our place, in our sense of self, in our sense of me, in our sense of our position, etc., etc. But what constitutes his awakening is this shift from a perspective where we're preoccupied with our place to one in which we glimpse, or perhaps more to the point, we learn how to live from a perspective that's not conditioned by greed and hatred and self-interest. So in other words, this ground is not an end in itself, the final goal of Buddhist practice, but it's actually, as it were, coming to find your own feet on your own ground in such a way that you can live from that perspective. That's how I would understand it. And as we probably are aware, after this enlightenment or awakening experience, he's actually kind of confused as to what to do. He doesn't think people will get this. He describes what he's understood as Patisotagami, going against the stream. It's counterintuitive somehow. It's not in tune with how people generally think or teach, particularly in his period of time in India. Now, someone wants to get in the door here. Okay, she shut the outer door, that's good. There we go. Well, okay, so that's the first text. That's hard to see. So what do we mean then by clearly visible? Now, to look at this particular passage, or the particular way I want to look at this idea of being clearly visible, is to go to a dialogue with that's recorded between the Buddha and a man called Topnot Sivaka. Sivaka was a wandering mendicant of the Buddha's time. He must have had some sort of hair knot on his head. He's not a Buddhist, but he appears twice in the Pali Canon, and on both occasions he asks a very pertinent question. In the first case, about the nature of karma, in which the Buddha gives a very unconventional, from a Buddhist point of view, answer. And in the second case, about what do you mean by the Dharma being clearly visible? This is what Topnot Sivaka says. He says, "You talk of a clearly visible Dharma. In what respects is the Dharma clearly visible?" And then he goes on with another set of qualifications. "In what sense is the Dharma immediate, inviting, uplifting, to be personally experienced by the wise?" But the point that he's homing in on is clearly visible. The other attributes are often strung together like this. It's a very famous early definition of the Dharma. The Dharma is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, to be personally experienced by the wise. Now, the Buddha then replies, but he doesn't just give Sivaka a definition, which he could have done, I guess. He could have said, okay, what I mean is X. Instead, he sets it up as a dialogue. He says, okay, let me ask you a question about this. Respond as you see fit. What do you think, Sivaka? When there is greed within you, do you know, oh, there's greed within me? And when there is no greed within you, do you know, ah, there is no greed within me? And Sivaka says, yeah, of course. And then the Buddha, in the rather repetitive manner of the suttas, asks the same question to Sivaka with regard to hatred, confusion, and those qualities of mind associated with greed, hatred, and confusion. On each occasion, Sivaka says, yeah, I know what it's like when there's greed, hatred, etc. in me, and I know what it's like when there's not. And then the Buddha says, well, it is in this way, Sivaka, that the Dharma is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, to be personally experienced by the wise. Now, I find this passage very compelling. And for a number of reasons. Firstly, in the teaching style itself, it's somewhat similar to the approach of Socrates. Socrates famously considered himself to be like a midwife. In other words, he saw his job as about drawing forth wisdom and understanding from the students, not telling them what's what and getting to them to memorize what he said, but actually engaging in a dialogue which gets them to somehow understand what it is they're trying to understand themselves. So Sivaka wants to know what it means for the Dharma to be clearly visible. The Buddha then asks him a series of questions in which Sivaka himself acknowledges that, yeah, I know what it's like to be greedy, and I also know what it's like not to be greedy, or hateful or confused or whatever. And then the Buddha says, oh, okay, that's what I mean by the Dharma being clearly visible. In other words, this nirvana, or this Dharma, or this conditionality, is something that is actually right here and now. And this is actually a plug for tomorrow's workshop, which is going to build on this particular theme, but in a more practical sense, hopefully. There is, in fact, another sutta where the Buddha is talking to a Brahmin called Janusoni, where instead of the word Dharma, he says Nirvana. Nirvana is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, and so on. Now, here we have, therefore, a passage in which the Buddha is saying Nirvana is actually right here before your eyes, if only you would open them and see it, but at the same time, it's very difficult to see. In the Zen tradition, they have a lovely image that I think illustrates this quite well. They talk about a fish who swims, who spends its whole life swimming through the ocean in search of water. In other words, the water is clearly visible, but it's hard to see. Nirvana, these moments in which we are freed from the imperatives of our greed and our hatred, our attachment to place and all these things, is clearly visible. Pretty much in any moment when those impulsive, instinctive habits come to rest, when they die down, before they spring up again. That is nirvana. That is also what the Buddha calls the unconditioned. It's also what he calls the deathless. And he uses exactly the same phrase, which in Pali is lobhakayo, dosakayo, mohakayo. The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of confusion is his definition of nirvana, his definition of the deathless, and his definition of the unconditioned. The three words are synonymous. Now, we know from our historical studies that these words had very, you know, loaded meanings in the Buddha's time. What he does is he takes all of them, and all of them are basically the way of talking about the highest spiritual or religious goal, and he completely subverts that by saying this possibility to live in a way that's not conditioned by greed and hatred and egoism, to live in a way that's not, as it were, a kind of inner death in which you are literally kind of stuck with your attachments and your fears and your hatreds. In other words, the deathless is the absence of that inner death. And nirvana, which is basically just the absence or the blowing out of these tendencies. These are synonymous for the Buddha. And they're not being understood here as some sort of distant goal that one might get to after many, many years of practice. They're being presented as clearly visible, immediate. The word in Pali for immediate is akaliko, which means timeless, literally. But Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as immediate, which I think is correct. What it means is that nirvana is not something you need to spend, you know, lots of time developing yourself in order that you can get it. It's actually something that is present right here and now, immediate. It doesn't need to be mediated through any developmental process in time. It's the space, the non-reactive space that opens up each time you find yourself no longer under the clutches of greed and hatred and ego. And although it's quite popular in religion, and Buddhism is no exception, to depict the ordinary person as just a kind of a writhing mass of evil or good and, or let's say negative tendencies or ignorance or Buddhism has always had going on about this stuff, it almost gives you the impression that people are somehow beyond salvation. But here we have, I think, a very clear indication that that's not how the Buddha saw things at all. He saw that human beings had tremendous potential, that they were, if only they could somehow connect with their own innermost ground, which is oddly not much like a ground at all, because it's constantly shifting and changing and moving and modifying and fluctuating. And if they could somehow get in touch with that that quiet inner calm, which is not being not being stimulated or overwhelmed by emotions and instincts and all that kind of stuff, then we would have another perspective from which to live in this world. This world, not some future life, but here and now. So broadly speaking, these two passages that we've looked at this evening, I think open up a way of looking at Buddhism, or let's say the Buddha's teaching or the Dharma, which on the one hand goes back to very early sources in the canon, on the other hand helps us, helps illuminate the actual humanity of this man called Siddhartha Gautama, telling his own story in the first text, engaging in a very particular kind of dialogue with a stranger, this guy Sivaka, in the other text. And I think, as it were, opening up for us today the possibility that we can live this life fully in a way in which all of our humanity is engaged, through basically learning to get in touch with what the Buddha calls our ground. And this getting in touch with is perhaps the most challenging bit, not only because we seem to be instinctively primed not to do that, but rather to be preoccupied with our place or our desires or our fears or whatever. But through practice, and this can be meditation, or more than anything else, just the ongoing self-examination, the paying of close attention to what goes on in the core of our moment-to-moment experience, learning to still and stabilize that attention, and learning to observe with greater precision and greater acuity what's actually coming up, arising, passing from moment to moment. That's the field of a practice that each of us, each person in the world, has the capacity to explore and to refine in such a way that over the course of time, our perspective on life begins to undergo not just momentary shifts like when we go on a retreat, but more and more we learn to tune ourselves to this kind of outlook, this kind of what we might call in English a sensibility to ourselves, to others, to the world. And that, I feel, is what the Buddha's Dharma is essentially about. So I'll stop talking here. We have still a fair bit of time to explore any of these things through comments or questions. The floor is yours.